Welcome. I want to welcome all of you in the Carmel campus, and those that are in our Greater Lafayette campus, and those that are in our Fishers campus. We are so glad that you are here. You know, last month I was gone, but the month before in February, at the end of the service, once a month we have what we call our miracle prayer time, where we invite people to come up who need a miracle in some area of their life, or at a dead end in some area of their life. And in February, in all three services, I prayed for probably around 14 or 15 couples, which is about how many I usually pray for. And I told Sandy when I got home that day, I said, every single couple except for one were marriage issues. Every single couple except for one said they need a miracle in their marriage. It bothered me, not just that week, it bothered me for several weeks after that. We forget sometimes you talk to couples and it feels like everything is okay with everybody, not knowing that sometimes behind closed doors that's not the case. 50% of the marriages today end in divorce, and the same holds true whether it's a Christian marriage or not. 70% of second marriages end in divorce. So it's a critical problem. And so that's the reason we're doing this Marriage 7.0 for Northview University, bringing in Stephen Otterburn, who is just a best-selling author, knows this subject well. And to be honest with you, I think we should pack this place out. I can't imagine why every married couple would not want to be here. Now, I know that there are some of you that would say, well, guys, Steve, it sounds like it's going to be a good deal, but, you know, life is busy, and I've got a lot going on, and we just got back from spring break, and it starts this Thursday, and I just don't know if there's any way I can find time. And I just want to say, really? Marriage, other than your relationship with Jesus Christ, marriage is the most important relationship this side of heaven. And anything that's going to be that important is going to take work. And, some people say, well, you know, we're not divorced. We hang in there. And basically, you're just existing together. You're coexisting under the same roof. And is that really what you want in a marriage relationship? So I'm just saying, I don't know why anybody would not take advantage of this and be here. It's 6 weeks, and I really do believe that it will be helpful. I mean, seriously, we can seat 2,000. We ought to be packed out. We ought to have to turn people away. There should be so many of you that want to be here for this. And you say, well, you know, I'm single. What's that have to do with me? And, you know, well, do you plan on being single the rest of your life? Maybe some of you do, but, if there's a chance that you're going to get married, why not get in front of this thing? You know, why not go ahead and learn some of these principles as well? So I just want to encourage you to come. And ladies, right now is a perfect time for you to jab your husband in the ribs. It's a perfect time to do that. Go ahead. You have my permission. Just jab him. And guys, this would be a perfect time to get some brownie points, to turn to your wife right now and just say, you know, I think we should attend this. Go ahead. You take a minute. We should attend this. We should be here for this. So seriously, I hope that you'll make plans to come and be a part of this. I really do feel like it's going to be such a big help in so many people's lives. Well, pray with me. I think that's really all I wanted to talk about today. Let's get into this. Father, I thank you and I praise you for your faithfulness in our life. You're an incredible God, and we thank you, Lord, for your presence here today. As we worshiped you tonight, it was obvious that you are alive and well and that you are in the middle of our presence here. We thank you for that, oh God. Lord, I thank you for what you're doing at Northview. I see the video of Habitat for Humanity and participated in that today. And just to think how we're reaching out to hurting and to those around our community, I know that you have to be pleased. I pray, dear God, that not only would you continue to bless Northview, but I pray that you would bless every congregation in this community that's teaching about your amazing love. I thank you for Carmel Lutheran right across the street. I thank you for that great congregation. I thank you for their pastor, Luther Brunette. And I just pray, dear God, you'd continue to bless him and use him in a mighty way. And hopefully we'll be able to link arms together to make a difference throughout central Indiana. Thanks, God. We just love you and praise you. We just ask all this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen. There is a story told about Benjamin Franklin that when he was the ambassador of France, true story, that when he was the ambassador of France, that he occasionally attended a club called the Infidels Club. And it was a group that spent time spent most of its time searching for and reading literary masterpieces. Well, on one occasion, Benjamin Franklin read a book, the Book of Ruth, to this particular club, but he changed the names so that they wouldn't recognize it as a story out of the Bible. When he had finished, the listeners were unanimous in their praise. They said it was one of the most beautiful short stories they had ever heard and insisted that he tell them where he had found such a remarkable work of art. Imagine how surprised they were when he told them it was straight out of the Bible, that it was the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. Well, today we're ready for chapter 9 of the story. Chapter 9, that is about the story of Ruth. How many of you read chapter 9? Let me see your hands. You rock. How many of you have your copy of the story with you? Let me see it. You can't just raise your hand. You got to show the book. Yeah. Now, for those of you that haven't read it, and for those of you that didn't bring it, mainly for those of you that didn't read chapter 9, please don't give up on me here. I want you to hang in this. I know we're only in week 9 of 31 weeks, and I really do believe that if you hang in on this thing, it's only 10 to 12 pages a week, that you're going to learn so much by the time we're through this thing, that you're going to understand the story of the Bible, the story of God's Word. So if you don't like to read, again, you just go to our website, and there you can, they'll read it to you. And so it's very, very easy, and so I encourage you to be a part of this and just stay disciplined in this particular area. I don't know about you, but this story, as you read it this week, maybe you found the story of Ruth just doesn't seem to fit with what we've been looking at. Now, don't get me wrong. It's absolutely an incredible story that begins with despair and ends with delight. But it just seems out of place to what we've been reading so far. We've been talking about the time of judges, and Ruth is certainly not a judge. And at first glance, it doesn't even seem to be about the nation of Israel. So then you wonder, why in the world is it even in the Bible? Well, friends, again, it's important to understand that all the way from Genesis to Revelation, there is a thread that runs all the way through the Bible, and that each of these stories interconnect with each other, and then we're going to see that each of these stories not only interconnect with each other, but they interconnect with our life. In other words, these stories are relevant to us today. I don't know how many times I've talked to people that said, well, you know, I don't care about reading the Old Testament because it's not relevant to my life today. And I would push back and say, oh, I don't agree with that. I think the Old Testament stories are extremely relevant to where we're living our lives today. So I want to encourage you to see the relevance, to get into these stories. In fact, Paul wrote in Romans chapter 15, he says, "For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope." You see, I think when Paul wrote that, I think he was talking about the Old Testament stories, the Old Testament writings, including the book of Ruth. Paul is saying, by hearing these stories, we will be more able to endure tough times, and we will be encouraged as we learn together. And in the process, our hope and confidence in Christ will only grow. Remember, we've said in every part of this, in fact, even Easter last weekend, I found a way to put that in there, but there is a lower story and there is an upper story. And I'm going to hammer away at this because I think it's going to be a paradigm shift in so many people's lives when they get a hold of this. The lower story is the visible world. It's what we see with our eyes. It's all around us every day. But there is an upper story, which is in the invisible world, and it's what God is doing in each and every circumstance of our life. You have to understand, friends, that God is involved. Sometimes we don't get that. We don't understand that God cares about every circumstance and situation. In Romans chapter 8, 28, you're familiar with the verse. "And we know that in all things," not some things, not most things, "in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." So it's important to know that even though we might not always be able to see exactly what God's doing, we know that he promises to be at work in every one of our situations. Our story begins today with a famine in the land of Bethlehem. Now, this is a famine so severe that this family could no longer stay. Elimelech takes his wife Naomi and his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they move to Moab. Elimelech. How would you like to have a name, Elimelech? I kept saying that over and over, and I thought, it sounds like a laxative. Elimelech. Take two pills today, get relief in the morning. Elimelech. Well, that was his name. And he took his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they moved to Moab to find food. Now, we know this had to be a serious famine, folks, for Elimelech to leave his property. You see, you have to understand the culture of the day. Property was a part of who the family was. It was part of their identity. Each family had a piece of land that was designated to them in the promised land. So they were given in the promised land, every family was given this property, and it was to be passed down from generation to generation. So you don't just leave your property. So you know they had to be in desperate straits to not only leave the property, but to move to Moab. Moab was such a pagan culture. And so these Jewish people are leaving the promised land area to go to a pagan culture. Moab was actually descendants of Sodom. Remember Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, they hadn't been there very long when Elimelech suddenly gets sick and he dies. Now, if you think things were tough before, they're really tough for Naomi. Here is Naomi, a single mom, raising two boys. Now, we know that that's a difficult thing to do in 2013 for a single mom to raise two children. But it was even more difficult in those days. Because to be honest with you, I don't know how else to say it, but they considered women just above dogs. And so because of that, there was no benefits, there was no advantage for women. There was really, she immediately went into poverty, but they were already in poverty. So it's hard to comprehend what they probably were going through. And so she has to raise both of these boys. Both of her boys grow up and they marry, remember they went to Moab, and they marry Moabite women, which was frowned upon by the Jews, as you can imagine, because the Moabite women were considered pagans in that culture. Now one of the girls was named Orpah, and Orpah married Chilion, and the other was Ruth, and she married Mahlon. Orpah. There you go again. How would you like to have the name Orpah? It sounds like a killer whale. It sounds like a seal or something. I mean, I hope we don't have anybody by the name Orpah in any of our campuses. I know I'm going to hear about it if we do. An interesting side note is that you may or know this or may not, Oprah Winfrey, her mother wanted to name her Orpah, but the nurse transposed, this is from her, this is her telling the story. She said the nurse transposed two letters and came out with Oprah. I don't know which is worse, but it stuck. And so that's how she was named Oprah. She was originally supposed to be called Orpah. Well, they all live in Moab for 10 years. So a decade now has gone by. When both of Naomi's sons die, you know, things have not gone well for Naomi. Not only does she poor and they have to give up their land in Bethlehem, but now they come to this pagan culture and her husband up and dies on her. She's left to raise two boys. Her boys marry Moabite women and now they die. And so it leaves these three women penniless without a male protector. Can you imagine the incredible grief of Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws? I'm sure many of you can relate to that pain. Many of you have lost loved ones. Many of you have lost a spouse. Many of you have lost a parent, or maybe you've lost a child. And you understand the type of grief that Naomi had to be going through. And yet I'll say there's probably some of you that have never lost anyone close to you, so you can't even begin to relate to the pain that she experienced. But you will. You say, well, what does that mean? You will. Because you see, none of us are exempt from loss. Every single one of us will lose people that we love and people that we care about. Some just sooner than others. Now you have to understand that grief is an important part of life. Grief is a difficult thing to go through, and grief is a hard thing that we experience in our life, but grief really is a God thing. Jesus experienced grief. In Isaiah chapter 53, it says, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Now this might surprise you, but grief is actually a healthy thing in our life. It's emotion, as I said, that's designed by God to help us deal with the losses that we experience or the losses that we go through. God uses grief to help us heal. He uses grief to help strengthen us in our faith. Grief is about coming to terms with the fact that things are never going to be the same again. Things are never going to be the same again. Something has been lost and it's never coming back. And that's how Naomi must have felt at this moment of her life. After losing everything, there's actually nothing there for her. I mean, she thinks, why stay now? I'm in a foreign land with a people that don't worship my God. My husband is dead. My sons are gone. I have nothing, so I might as well go home. I might as well go back to where I'm from. I might as well go back to my own people. So she has a conversation with her two daughter-in-laws, and she explains to them, she says, there's nothing holding me here anymore, and both of you are young. So she said, you need to stay. These are your people, so you need to stay here, and you need to remarry. You're young enough to have children. Orpah agrees, and she says that she's going to stay. She's broken. She's emotional because both of them love Naomi greatly. And Orpah decides that she's going to stay, but Ruth immediately stands up and refuses. She's not going to leave Naomi. And so turn in your story, if you would, to page 122. 122. Look at it down right at the center of the page there. It says, as they wept aloud again, this is that moment that they're talking about this. All three of them are crying. They wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Does that sound familiar? I know you just heard him sing it in the song. You heard it, but had you heard it before? Because it's oftentimes quoted in weddings. You've heard that many times. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. It's quoted between a groom and a bride, but that's not the scenario here. In fact, if we were to try to make it applicable today, it would be the bride standing up in front of the people, turning to her mother-in-law and saying to her mother-in-law, where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. It ain't gonna happen, is it? It just isn't gonna happen. I don't really think it's something that's gonna catch on. So what is happening here? Ruth deeply loved Naomi. That's very, very obvious. So Ruth goes with Naomi, and they go back to Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is a very small community. There was only about 200 people that lived in Bethlehem. And remember, Naomi is from Bethlehem, and her family is still in Bethlehem, and her descendants are still in Bethlehem. And so they knew her, but she hasn't been back in over a decade. And so her and Ruth travel back to Bethlehem, and as they're on their way and they're coming from a distance, you know, 200 people is not too many, and people are working about their day, and all of a sudden they see two women coming into the town way off, maybe a couple miles down the road, and everybody stops, and people start to notice that these are women because you never saw women traveling together. It was too dangerous. So they always traveled with men, but in this particular occasion, these two women are coming into the town. People, I think, in Bethlehem are starting to gather together trying to figure out who are these people. And as they get a little bit closer, somebody says, you know who that looks like? That looks like Naomi. No, somebody else argues, that can't be Naomi. She's changed. It's too much. It's been over a decade. Somebody says, yeah, but where's her husband? Where's her boys? And who's this gal that's traveling with her? And so she just continues to get closer and closer. And finally, somebody shouts out and says, is that you, Naomi? Where's your husband? Where's your sons? Now, I need to tell you before I go any further that Naomi's name means pleasant or sweet. You have to understand that, you know, when we come up with a name today for our kids, it doesn't usually have anything to do with what that name means. It's just we like the name. More times than not, people say, well, I like the name Jim, and so let's name our son Jim. We're not thinking about the meaning of Jim, but in Bible times, it was completely different. In Bible times, the meaning of the name was extremely important to parents. And so we see here that Naomi literally means pleasant or sweet. And to be honest with you, that from everything you read in history, that really was Naomi's characteristic. That really was her nature. That's who she was. And so I'm sure that these ladies, they haven't seen her in over a decade, and they remember her, they hear her name, and they remember this is Naomi, this is a very, very sweet lady, a very, very pleasant lady, and it's so good to see her. But as I've said, Naomi's gone through a difficult time, a great deal of pain and disappointment in the last decade. So her response to these curious onlookers is basically, do I look pleasant? Do I look sweet? No. No, not at all. So don't call me by that name anymore. And so they're like, well, hello to you too. I mean, she has become an angry individual. She's gone through a lot and she's very upset. Go back to page 122 again at the bottom paragraph. She says, don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. I'd say Naomi's ticked. Naomi is angry. She is mad at God. This is not at all the way she thought her life was supposed to go. She thought she was going this direction, and all of a sudden, life took a turn this direction. She thought she was going with her husband and her sons to get a life again. They'd lost everything. She thought they were going to be able to build it back up and get on their feet again. But instead, her husband dies, and both of her boys die. So she's angry at God. She doesn't understand what's happening. Friends, have you ever been angry at God? How many of you be honest enough to say, I've been mad at God? Yeah, and the rest of you are dealing with lying. So all of us have been angry probably at one time or another. I shouldn't have said that, I'm sorry. All of us at one time or another have been angry at God because things didn't go the way we thought they should. You know, we thought we were going this direction. We had a plan in mind. We knew what it was we wanted to accomplish, and it didn't work out, did it? It took a different direction. There was a whole lot of pain that came our way. God didn't do what we thought he was supposed to do. You're married to this wonderful person when all of a sudden the rug gets ripped out from under you and they file for divorce. You thought your job was secure and you get a pink slip. You thought your marriage was strong and you've always been healthy, but the doctor says you're sick. So how does this happen? Listen, friends, it's easy to trust God when everything is going our way. But the real question is, are you willing to trust him when the rug gets ripped out from under you? Are you willing to trust him when your heart is broken and full of pain, or when it aches with the regret of missed opportunities? Are you still willing to trust God then? Do you see how this is relevant to today? That's what I'm saying to you. There's not a story found in the Old Testament that is not applicable, that is not relevant to the life we're living today. And every one of us have gone through those times where we can relate to Naomi. We can relate to being ticked at God because he didn't do things our way. He didn't do things the way we thought they should go. And so, friends, that's why you have to ask the question, am I going to trust God or not? You might shrug your shoulders. There may be some of you here today, and you shrug your shoulders and say, okay, sirrah, sirrah, what's it matter, Steve? Life's pretty good for me. Things are going well for me. Things are going the way that I want. You know, I'm not going to think about all this negativity that you're bringing up. I'm not going to go there. Well, friends, the problem with not going there, the problem with not thinking about it now, is that if you wait till you find yourself in the middle of a crisis, and then you try to decide whether you're going to trust God or not, when you get there, your legs will buckle. When you get there, your spiritual life will hit a wall. You have to make the decision before you ever arrive at those moments in life that no matter what, I'm going to trust God. That no matter what my circumstances, no matter how difficult this is that I'm going through, I've made up my mind that it's for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. I have made that determination, friends. I'm just telling you, because if you don't predetermine that, you're not going to be able to survive it. It's what Joshua said in 24:15. But if you refuse to serve the Lord, then choose today whom you will serve. Would you prefer the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates, or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live? But as for me and my family, we will serve the Lord. Joshua said, I've drawn a line in the sand. I've already predetermined. I know things could get ugly. I know things can go awry, but it doesn't matter because even if they do, I'm going to serve the Lord. Well, Joseph is saying, come on, guys, or Joshua is saying here in that passage we just read, come on, guys, you have to decide today what's it going to be, because if you don't, it's not likely that you'll make the right decision in the heat and pressure of the moment. I found in Larry Crabb's book, Shattered Dreams, he writes, there's a great quote that I pulled out. It says, quote, somehow we must find a hope that continues through shattered dreams, a hope available to everyone regardless of their circumstances. We must discover a hope that thrives when dreams are shattered, when sickness advances, and when poverty worsens, and loneliness deepens, and obscurity continues. It's that same hope that anchors us to God who dreams. It's that same hope that anchors us to God when dreams do come true. You get what he's saying? The hope that we have when we see, when everything's going our way, when it feels like God's answering our prayers, when we feel like we're on a mountaintop, and that hope that we have in God on that mountaintop, we have to have that same hope when we're in the valleys of life. When we get down and nothing is going right, nothing is working right with our health, with our marriage, with our finances, with anything else, we have to have that same hope. In other words, we don't get to decide what roles we play in the story of our lives, but we do get to decide how we'll respond to those roles, to those circumstances that come our way. Like so many of us, I think Naomi just got caught up in the pain of the lower story and she temporarily lost sight of the fact that there was an upper story. Do you understand what I mean? I mean, sometimes when we're going life, I said to you a moment ago, when you begin to understand there is an upper story, it'll be a paradigm shift spiritually for you. It'll change the way you live your spiritual journey, your spiritual life. But I'll be honest with you, there's times when we get so caught up in the circumstances of life, we lose sight of the upper story. I think a perfect example of that would be Peter when he walked on the water. Do you remember when Peter gets out of the boat? I mean, he's looking at Jesus. Jesus is coming at him, walking on the water, and he's looking at him, and he has such hope. And it's such faith. And he pulls off his outer garment and he steps to the edge of that boat and the other disciples are yelling at him, have you lost your mind? Why? Because they're looking at him in the lower story. And they're saying, it's crazy, you can't walk on water. And he ignores them because his eyes are fixed on Jesus. His eyes are fixed on the upper story. And he steps out of the boat and he walks to Jesus. But what happens? The waves come rolling in. The storms come rolling in. And the very second he takes his eyes off Jesus and he looks to the lower story, he looks to the waves and the storms in life, he gets wet. He goes down. And he's drowning, he's choking. And all of a sudden, what does he do? He looks back to Jesus again and he pulls him out. And I'm saying, I think that's what happens to all of us at times. We get overwhelmed with the lower story. We get overwhelmed with the circumstances of life, and we take our eyes off of Jesus, and we go down. Our legs buckle. But that's why it's so important, again, I'll say to you, to predetermine that no matter what, no matter what comes my way, I'm going to keep my eyes fixed on Jesus. God was not finished with Naomi's story. That's important to understand. He wasn't done yet. He was still working in her situation. She was about to see God step into her tragedy and work it out for her good. So Ruth and Naomi, let's go back to our story. They arrive in Bethlehem. So how are these two widows going to survive? Again, it was very hard in those days. Well, there was a provision in the Old Testament back in Deuteronomy that makes provisions for the poor, and it's called gleaning. And basically what it was is that back in those days, it's amazing to me, and let me just say this, it's amazing to me in the Old Testament how most people were conscious of the poor and helping the poor. Not as much today. But anyway, in those days, according to Deuteronomy, the people that owned fields were to do gleaning. And what that meant was is that they told their workers as they were harvesting the crop that it's okay if you drop some of the crop. It's okay if you drop some of the product, some of the produce on the ground, because the poor are going to come in after you're out of the field and they're going to glean. And so also what they would do is that when they would make their turns, you know, like a farmer comes up and then they're plowing the ground and they'll work their way back down, they were told to kind of cut off the corners. So they would come up and cut off the corners so you'd have all four corners that they didn't get at all. And so the poor would come in and they would glean. They would take enough so that they would have food. So Ruth is much younger and stronger than Naomi. So she goes out to the field to glean some of the scraps, and she ends up being in the field of a man by the name of Boaz. And so she's gleaning. Boaz arrives that day, and he sees the woman. He thinks he knows who it is, but he's not sure. So he asks the people, who is that woman? And they tell him that it's Ruth. And he's heard the story about how Ruth stayed and was faithful to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And so he goes up to Ruth, and he says to her, I don't want you to go anywhere else. I've told my servants to leave even extra for you. Because what they would do, let me back up, what they would do is that if they didn't get enough out of this field, then they would go to the next landowner's field, and they would keep going until they were able to get enough to feed themselves. And so Boaz says to Ruth, I don't want you to go to the next field. I've told the man to leave enough behind for you. And I want you just to stay here in my property. He said, I've heard what you did for your mother-in-law since the death of her husband. He said, may you be blessed by the Lord for all you've done. Well, when Ruth got home that night, she tells Naomi what's taken place. She tells him about this man. And Naomi wants to know the man's name. I can just see Naomi working around the house, and she's hearing about Ruth's day. And Ruth tells her, and she says, well, that's interesting. What's his name? And she says, well, his name's Boaz. And Naomi sits up and says, what was his name? His name's Boaz. And Naomi couldn't believe what she's hearing, because Boaz was a descendant of her husband, Elimelech. It was family. And this is important. We'll see why. So go to page 124. And 124, go right to the center of the page where it says her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Now, in some translations, it says he is one of our kinsmen redeemers. It's the same meaning, and it's just different in different translations of the Bible. It means exactly the same thing. He is our kinsman redeemer. Now, the guardian redeemer, kinsman redeemer, is a male relative who, according, this is so important, so I want to try to explain this as well as I can. I want you to follow me on this. Who, according to the various laws in the Old Testament, says that if a man dies without an heir, the next of kin had the responsibility, or maybe she's attractive, so he had the privilege of marrying the widow. He's to love her as well as pay off her financial debts. He's to buy back the land that she sold. Remember, Naomi and Elimelech had sold their property. And so this kinsman redeemer, his responsibility is to buy it back for her. And if and when there is a child, then it comes from this new relationship, this new marriage, then he is to basically give the land to the heir, to the boy, to the child, so that they can continue the name of the deceased husband. I don't know if that makes sense or not. It certainly doesn't make sense in our culture, but follow me if you will, because this is really a big deal for us spiritually. So the kinsman redeemer was someone who delivers or rescues or redeems property or a person. So in this case, the property would be bought back and put in the name of Ruth's husband that died. Now remember, Ruth's husband was Mahlon. So his name would not be snuffed out, but would continue. Now, as you might imagine, this is a pretty big ask of kinfolk. You think about this. I mean, he's being asked to cash in his 401k. He's being asked to cash in his IRA to pay for property for somebody else. For him to jeopardize their financial estate to purchase some expensive property so that the name of a deceased relative that he may have been close to, or maybe he wasn't, so that his name could live on. But again, that was his responsibility as a kinsman redeemer. Now, there was no law that forced him. Nobody was putting a gun to his head to make him do it. So really, when it comes right down to it, it was up to him. He had the responsibility. It was expected. But again, nobody's going to force him to do this. Now, Naomi, when she realizes it, when she turns around and says, Boaz, he's family. He's our kinsman redeemer. She's excited because she realizes there is a chance for her to be redeemed. And she finally realizes God's not finished with us yet. When it feels like they had hit a wall, when it feels like she's angry, she's ticked at God, everything's gone wrong because she's lost focus on the upper story and all she sees is an invisible world where everything has gone wrong, everything stinks. And so she's mad at God. All of a sudden, she wakes up and realizes, hey, God may be doing something very unique here, very special here. So Naomi tells Ruth, you need to go take a shower. You need to go put on your finest clothes and your finest perfume because I'm about to play matchmaker. Well, Naomi instructs Ruth to wait until Boaz lies down to go to sleep that night and then to lie down beside his feet. Now, in those days, I know this is odd. We can't even begin to comprehend it in our culture. But again, follow the line of thinking on this and how it is applicable to us today. This is an overt proposal. She's stating to Boaz her intentions. She wants to be in a marriage with him. She wants to be in a relationship with him. I know this all seems, again, weird, but the idea of a kinsman redeemer buying property and inheriting the wife is the way it was done in that culture. Now, obviously, there was no guarantee that Boaz would accept this responsibility, though we could tell earlier Boaz had his eye on her. He thought she was attractive. Well, he wanted to know all about her, and he told her not to go to any other property, to stay right here, and he made sure that she had enough food, so she stayed right there. But he was a gentleman, and so therefore, he wasn't going to push his way in. He was waiting for her to tell him her intentions. And that's exactly what she's doing right now. It was one thing for him to let her glean from his field, but it was quite a remarkable thing that Boaz did here. A wealthy Jew would, remember, she was... Ruth was a Gentile. She wasn't Jewish. And so for Boaz, a wealthy Jew, that he would take a Gentile, a pagan, to be his wife. You say, well, yeah, but if she was attractive, there were a lot of attractive women that were Jews. This went against everything he believed in, everything that the Jewish culture believed. So this was a huge thing. Why in the world would he do this? Well, I think it helps us to understand, if I could digress from that just a minute, I think it helps us to understand that when you know who his mother was, it'll start to make sense. Boaz's mother was Rahab. Now, some of you understand that, and some of you don't know who I'm talking about. In Jericho, she was a prostitute. She was a foreigner who helped the Israelites when they were trying to take the promised land. Well, it turns out that Rahab, the prostitute, has a son, and she names her son Boaz. So what I'm saying to you is that Boaz grew up raised by a prostitute. I'm sure he was raised in poverty. I'm sure he was raised being disdained by other ones, looked down by everybody. I'm sure that he was raised in a difficult situation, a difficult home. But he grew up to be a man who honored God and who provided and protected those that were less fortunate. So Boaz shows this undeserved act of kindness, and God uses him to redeem this story. So Boaz exercises his obligation. He marries Ruth. Now, not only does he buy Ruth's deceased husband's property, not only does he buy Mahlon's property and give to Ruth, but he also buys back Kilian's property, and he also buys back Elimelech's property and gives to Naomi. He redeems them so their names might continue on. Then God redeems this story with a surprise ending. Ruth and Boaz give birth to a son, and they name him Obed. Look at page 127, right in the center of the paragraph, in the center of the page. So Boaz took Ruth, and she becomes his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer, a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took this child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is really important. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. The story ends with a genealogy. The genealogy. Ruth and Boaz have a child named Obed. And Obed would grow into an adult man. He would get married, and he would give birth to a son, and they would name him Jesse. Jesse would grow into a man, and he would get married and have a son, and his name would be David, the one we knew as King David. Now, we're not there yet in the story, so I'm getting ahead of you just a little bit. While the book of Ruth ends, the book of Ruth that we're in today ends with David, when you go to the New Testament, Matthew begins with the genealogy of Jesus. Look at it, Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. It says, "Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, the prostitute. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David." So, the original question I ask you today, what does this ancient love story have to do with our lives today? And as I've shared with you before, there is a thread of Jesus that you'll find all the way from Genesis to Revelation. People oftentimes think you don't get into Jesus until you get to the New Testament, and that's so untrue. You see Jesus talked about and described all the way from Genesis to Malachi in the Old Testament. Remember, let's go back just a little bit. Remember when God made a covenant with Abraham and Sarah, and he told them, I'm going to create a new nation, and it's going to come from your genealogy. And he was an old man. Sarah was an old woman, but it took place. We have the 12 tribes of Israel. And then we move forward, and we're not there yet. We're going to be there in a few weeks. But then he tells David, he reminds him that out of his genealogy is going to come the Messiah. And so it just continues to move forward. We see how this thing is unfolding with Jesus. So once again, we see the book of Ruth points to Jesus as our kinsman redeemer. And what I want you to see before I close this today is the symbolism and how it parallels between Boaz, Naomi, and Ruth. They were in our story today. Boaz, Naomi, and Ruth. How it compares with Jesus, Israel, and the church. Boaz was the kinsman redeemer, just like Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. Through Boaz, the act of redemption, he returns Naomi, who represents Israel. Remember, Naomi, she's Jewish. She was in Bethlehem. They had to let their property go. They lost their inheritance. The property was passed down from generation to generation. They lost their inheritance. They lost their home. They were separated from their people. And they go to a pagan culture. They go to a pagan country. And then a kinsman redeemer comes into the picture, and she's bought back. And she gets back her property. So it says Israel coming back to its land. And I'll go into that in another message. But I want you to follow this thinking. Then he takes Ruth. Now remember, Ruth is a Gentile. Remember, she was a Moabite. She's a Gentile. And he takes her as his bride. We are referred to, the church of Jesus Christ is referred to as the bride of Christ. This would suggest a parallel with the church as the Gentile bride of Christ. I think it's also interesting that no matter how much Boaz wanted Ruth, we know that he wanted Ruth. He told her not to leave the land, to stay there. He wanted her, but he was a gentleman, and therefore there was nothing that he would do until she declared herself. In other words, it was her choice. And so the picture you see there is that Jesus Christ paid the price. He paid the price. We were in relationship with God the Father, but because of sin in our life, that relationship was broken. We lost our inheritance. We lost our relationship. We lost our property. Anything you want to say there, we lost it. We were separated from God. Jesus, our kinsman redeemer, comes and he pays the price. What's the price? The wages of sin is death. Somebody had to die for our sins. So Jesus dies in our place. He becomes our kinsman redeemer and dies for our sins. To buy us back, to pay the price in full. But Jesus is a gentleman, and he's never going to override your free will, your freedom to choose. So in other words, even though the work has already been done, he waits upon you. He wants us to be his bride, but we have to accept him. We have to invite him into our life. And so just as Boaz waited for Ruth to lie at his feet and say, you know, to make her intentions very clear, Jesus waits for us. He'll never force you to follow him. It's your call. It's your decision.